We're back for another edition of Mormonland, the Salt Lake Tribune's podcast about LDS teachings and culture. I'm Dave Noyce, managing editor and religion editor here at the Tribune. I'm here again with our senior religion writer, Peggy Fletcher Stack. Hello, Peggy.
Hi, Dave.
Well, today we're talking with Nylan McBain. She's the author of Women at Church, Magnifying LDS Women's Local Impact, and the founder of the Mormon Women Project. She also has a new endeavor going on, CEO of Better Days 2020, an effort to popularize Utah women's history in preparation for major anniversaries coming in 2020. They're doing this through education, legislation, and art. Welcome, Nylan.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Well, let's start with a general question. What prompted you to get involved in Mormon women's issues?
Well, I had a very unusual upbringing, which I always start with when I'm asked this question, because it really formed the foundation of my perception of myself as a Mormon woman and has really influenced all of the work that I've done since my childhood. I was raised in New York City, right on the Upper West Side, by a single mother who had a substantial career and yet was very orthodox in her membership of the Manhattan wards there. And I had a wonderful upbringing with lots of creative and interesting people in the wards there. Gender was really not something that came to the fore in any of our experiences. My parents were divorced, and my mom was sort of the bedrock of my upbringing. And so I had in her an example of somebody who was embraced and used and appreciated and put to work by the church institution. And so it never really occurred to me that as an adult woman myself, this usefulness and this appreciation and this incorporation into the administration of the church would be something that I wouldn't experience too. I took it for granted that I would have similar experiences as my mother. So I was surprised as I got older and I found that same sentiment wasn't shared by a number of my female peers when I went to college at Yale University, and then when I moved to San Francisco right out of school to work and be a part of the wards there. And I had some key experiences that really pointed out to me that my perception of myself as a Mormon woman was really the anomaly and not the standard feeling of Mormon women in the mainstream church. And so I looked at one point at what I could do to help strengthen some of my friends and really help create a different narrative about what it means to be a Mormon woman, and specifically create a narrative that showed how there are many ways to choose the right, that being a Mormon woman doesn't necessarily need to be limiting in our vocations or in our particular personalities or in our choices for ourselves. We still have the opportunity and the responsibility to follow personal revelation, to make choices for ourselves that are right for not only ourselves, but our family and our unique personalities. And so that's why I started the Mormon Women Project in 2010. And since then, it's no longer under my editing leadership, but it's under wonderful new leadership. But in my time, and since then, we've interviewed almost 500 women from 22 countries around the world. And we've really focused on that theme of many ways to choose the right. And these women that we've interviewed have just shown me that there is no one way to be a Mormon woman. And it's given me lots of speaking opportunities as well and writing opportunities, which have brought me in contact with just some of the very best thinkers of our community, some of the best people of our community, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful ride for me.
So what prompted you to write your book, Women at Church? Was there an episode? Was there something beyond Mormon Women Project?
Yeah, I was given the opportunity in 2012 to speak at a large conference. It was the Fair Mormon Conference, the summer of 2012. And I really hadn't done that much public speaking. We'd done events for the MWP, which I had, spoken at and led, but nothing where I was personally asked to share my opinions about what I learned in my time studying Mormon women. And this opportunity presented itself because I was recommended by a person in public affairs, which I deeply appreciated, and I took the calling very seriously, the opportunity seriously, and it was an hour-long talk. And so at that point was really the first time when I started putting my thoughts on paper about what it meant to me to be part of an institution that has a male leadership, has a male priesthood leadership, and an institution in which I saw a number of my sisters and friends and ward members struggling with women's positions in the church. And so it was kind of a breakthrough moment for me. And I had a pesky editor approach me after that, who just over the next year or so convinced me to turn that talk into a book. And I will be forever grateful to him for giving me that confidence and really seeing that. So the book was really came out of a desire to share the knowledge that I was gaining from talking to so many Mormon women, because I really was out there collecting information, not just about testimonies, but sort of a sociological exploration of what our women are really doing on a daily basis and how they're incorporating their testimonies and their spiritual lives within their daily choices.
So what were some of the suggestions you made for gender equity in the church without giving women the priesthood, or without giant structural changes or doctrinal changes?
Yeah, the book is really addressed to those in the church who might not have understood or may not understand why a family member or a friend doesn't relish their identity as a woman in the church, or is concerned from a male point of view about the identity of women in the church. And so it was a very practical guide. This is why some people feel this way. And these are a few things that we can do about it, even as mainstream members who have not perhaps considered the possibility of sort of priesthood ordination for women. And so the book, I really intended to read sort of as a guide and as a how-to, to understand, first of all, and then how to implement sometimes small, sometimes bigger changes to the way we practice Mormonism in our administrative settings. And so, yeah, the ideas ranged from the small to the large. I think really what we were getting at is increasing the visibility and the voice of women and girls within the institutional church community. So we were looking at where do you see female leaders in church meetings? Do you ever see them up on the stand? Do you ever see them as ecclesiastical authorities once you get past the age of 12? For instance, for a boy, that doesn't happen. So I talked about things like that. When does a man actually see a woman as an ecclesiastical authority, both in visibly and in her voice? And the current answer is pretty much never. And so what can we do about that? And so I started making suggestions, again, which were entirely in keeping with our current doctrinal structure and with the handbook, such as placing the Stake Relief Society presidency on the stand during a ward or state conference. It's a gesture towards visibility, but, you know, in the people that I interviewed, and even still, very few people can identify or name, even the women of a ward or state can identify or name the female leaders of that local area. And that's a shame. That's so sad, because those female leaders have an ecclesiastical responsibility and a stewardship for the women in that stake, and as they sit in councils for the men too. And so this idea of actually being able to see them, and for our women and girls to be able to see that women are part of those decision-making councils, was a really important thing. So that's just one example. Of course, another example was including young women in visiting teaching companionships, because there's such a huge disparity in the way our girls are used and needed in the ward experience compared to the way boys are used and needed. And I often have brought up the idea that if the young women's program did not exist in a ward, or if it were completely disbanded, nothing in the life of a ward would meaningfully change. Whereas if you got rid of, you know, some of the other groups, there would be adjustments, right? We are not using our girls in a way that requires sacrifices from them to tether them to the institution. They feel that lack of use. They feel that lack of need for them. And so they end up being gospel consumers during those years, which doesn't create that, you know, as Joseph Smith said, that sacrifice required to tether us to the institution. So I, you know, one of the ideas was exactly to have young women participate in some of the Relief Society activities. So there's that bridge there, like there is for young men as they participate in priesthood quorum activities, and then specifically have young women join their Relief Society sisters in visiting teaching. So obviously, I'm thrilled about their most recent changes. I think that they're a significant step in recognizing the disparities that have existed between our youth programs and the way that we've treated boys and girls and their engagement in ward affairs. And I really have a lot of hope for them.
So that recent change, to clarify, was the church essentially doing away with what they call home teaching and visiting teaching, and now a new approach called ministering. And part of that is going to involve the young women, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, at its core, it's pretty much a rebranding of the program. But I do think the significant structural change is the participation of the young women. I think that that's really the most significant change.
Have you seen other things that have happened since your book came out that shows some strides toward
equity and visibility?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, there's nothing that I love more than getting, anecdotal and also data feedback on people who have implemented the ideas in the book. And you know, there are a couple of particular people that have contacted me over the years and kept up a relationship with me and kind of told me what's happening in their wards and stakes. Oftentimes, it's women who I got, an email the other day that told me that my book is being used kind of as a handbook in her stake. I will say, though, that most of the people that I'm in touch with and who report to me regularly are men. They're stake presidents and mission presidents. And I'm delighted to hear from them. And I understand that it's the men who need to be our advocates in this work because of the way the church is structured. And I hope that it's not always like that. But I understand now that we do need to rely on some of these men in those very highest levels to be implementing these things and to help introduce our congregations to new traditions and new ways of seeing the female leaders in the ward.
Some of the things you wrote about, you steps you said could be taken, for instance, were establish parity between budgets for Cub Scouts and activity days. Things are, of course, happening on the Scouts front. Honor girls in front of the congregation at key ages, just as boys are. Involve women in baby blessings led by the all-male priesthood. Assign young women to be permanent Sunday greeters. Have young women hold the microphones at a testimony meeting. You also talked about allowing members to have a woman sit in worthiness interviews with male priesthood interviews. We've seen some movement on that. Mm-hmm. And then just to quote more female sources in sermons and Relief Society and things like that. Have you seen some of those things we've seen happen?
We have.
Some we haven't.
Yeah, we have, absolutely.
What about, for instance, the worthiness interviews with the changes that the church made there?
So I think it's in a wonderful direction, and I'm grateful that you had that list there to remind me of all of these things that we've talked about. Yes, some of them we are definitely moving in the direction of doing, because I think that the bottom line for people is really the bottom line of the book. The thing that I wanted to come out of the book, and I think that the thing that list represents is this something that requires priesthood authority and priesthood keys to administer ordinances? Is that what is really needed here in this situation, right? And in some situations, the answer will be yes, and it may always be yes. But in other situations, my point was always to challenge with that question. Is that really necessary right here? I heard some just horror stories over the course of collecting these stories, that men need to say the opening prayers in all meetings, right? And then sometimes people would say, oh, no, it's the closing prayers that men always need to say, right? And some I heard bishops who wouldn't let the Relief Society president start a fifth Sunday meeting unless he was there and all of his counselors. I mean, all of those things are absurd. Of course, when you get into worthiness issues, we have the stewardship of the bishop, but there's absolutely no reason why that has to be a singular and limited experience just for him. There's absolutely no reason. And if there is an appropriate setting in which a woman can be present, it seems like it's completely the wise and rational and kind thing to do, right? And that's what we're going for. We should always be going for the rational and wise and kind thing. some cases, the only thing that I have been worried about is that in some cases, of course, the parents are the problem, right? And so that's right. why I think the church's approach to still making it something optional is probably a wise approach. I know that there has been concern about that. Well, if you make it optional, then no one's going to actually take you up on it. And that I think we just have to give it a little bit of time and see how it plays out. But I do think that leaving that loophole in case the parents are the problem and the child or the youth really does need the bishop to be the sole, person of trust there, I think leaving that open as an option is important.
Mm-hmm. So what were the most controversial recommendations you made, and what kinds of pushback have you gotten on those? Can you think of one?
Yes. Well, I'll think of one just because I was talking about it with a friend the other day. I didn't actually make this recommendation in the book. What I did was actually drop in the personal essay by a person who experienced this and really liked it for herself. And so I guess it served as an example of something that could be done. But this woman felt connected to the sacrament by making the bread for the sacrament. And this particular example kind of it's a good example because it shows the kind of thinking that we have to do when we look at these kinds of recommendations. She was looking for a way as a woman to be connected to this main ordinance, which according to the Doctrine and Covenants does need priesthood keys to oversee the blessing of the bread and the water. And it's a very lovely essay that she writes and has contributed. And the result of that behavior was very positive for her. Of course, there's a lot of backlash about that being a very gendered way to participate in the sacrament that, women are just back in the kitchen making the bread, and I completely see that and agree with that. But the thinking I really appreciate, which is, again, that there is no specific way and there's no specific need for our young women in the Sunday experience, right? And so when we go through what happens on Sunday or when we go through what happens at a state conference or at a ward conference, I think it's really good for us to challenge ourselves to figure out, what do those girls need to get up in the morning to do? Right. I often talk about how when I was in college, when I went to Yale, of course, at Yale, you're up at 2 a.m. as college students do, and Saturday nights. Right. And our church started at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning because of, hours with the dining halls and stuff. Of course, they weren't accommodating the Mormon kids. So we had to accommodate the dining hall. So our meetings were always from 9 to 12, even though that was really painful on a Sunday morning. So, of course, the elders quorum's calling up all these undergraduate boys, we need you here for the sacrament. We need you here to pass the sacrament. You need to be dressed and showered. And as a member of the Relief Society presidency in that ward myself, there was nothing I could do to call the girls on Sunday morning and be like, okay, it's 8:30, 8:45, get out of bed and get to church, right? Except to say, we love you. We want to have you here. It's just so wonderful when you're here. You share your sweet spirit with us, So this challenge of finding something for the girls to really do to be useful on Sunday is something that I tackled in the book and have not found a great answer for.
So are there rules precluding these things? Like, for instance, greeters or passing the microphone for like when they have fast and testimony meeting? Are there rules in place that in the handbook
that
says this is who does it? Or
I think it's purely tradition. As I said, that's the perfect kind of example to say, okay, do you really need the priest to hold a microphone? Right. No, you don't. And I think it's tradition. I'm Young Women's President right now, and I love my ward council and my bishop, but I have noticed that when there are things and there are jobs to be done in the ward, we default to the young men, right? We default to the elders' quorum or the young men. And listen, the Relief Society has got its hands full. It's represented by a single presidency, whereas previous to this, the men had two presidencies, right? Because they had elders' quorum and high priests in the ward council. But we do default to young men when we have tasks. And so I try to speak up and just say, hey, the young women can do that too, And so I think that's always are we involving all the youth, or do we have this gendered, deeply ingrained perception that work at church needs to be done by the young men?
So let me just ask you a quick question. If a bishop decided to, I'm going to have the women pass the mic, would that bishop get in trouble?
he would only get in trouble if a stake president felt uncomfortable with that. But I'm pretty confident that, I mean, there's nothing that I have found that would give that uncomfortable stake president a leg to stand on and actually, you know, prosecuting an infraction like that. You know, that's one of the beauties and one of the complete frustrations of the church is that, you know, we're a worldwide church and then we're just as big as our own ward, right? And these things, I mean, living here in Utah, I've heard stories from neighboring stakes in Utah Valley that are literally like blocks apart where people are having vastly different experiences with these kinds of principles. And so, you know, one of the purposes of the book also was to help create some sort of consistent standard or to change the standard a little bit. People are always going to have varying experiences based on who their local leadership are. But, you know, hopefully the influence of the women on that local leadership will increase and hopefully there will be more of a standardization of those experiences.
What about the one thing, again, you didn't propose it as a practice, but women holding their babies during the baby blessing. And there is a fair amount of push on that.
Yeah.
Do you see that changing? Do you see anybody trying it out?
Oh, I see lots of people trying it out. As back to the previous point, there's a huge variety of responses to it and in what's being allowed and what's not being allowed. You know, that particular thing is different than some things in that it does have a scriptural directive associated with it from the Doctrine and Covenants. And, you know, I think it's an absolutely beautiful and wonderful idea, and especially when we're getting more into this rhetoric of, you know, women jointly holding the priesthood, having the priesthood themselves. Even though, you know, we always have the distinction made that they don't have the keys and authority to perform ordinances, right? But if the ordinance is being, and it's not even an ordinance, if the blessing is being performed by a man, there's no like contaminating force that this woman is going to be bringing to the circle by, you know, physically holding this baby. I mean, to think that is absurd and insulting. And so as we get to this point in our rhetoric where we're saying, you know, men and women are working together and they're both needed to accomplish the purposes of the priesthood, and we, you know, we're not even talking about the boys being, you know, it's not the priesthood, quote unquote, passing the sacrament anymore. It seems like a natural next step to have the baby blessing include the completing piece of that priesthood partnership. You know, even if the blessing itself is still said by the dad. So it's interesting. I actually, since the book came out on that particular piece, I've become myself much more vehement. Like if I had a baby today, I would absolutely be doing that. Whereas before I was kind of like, oh, I don't know if I need that, but it's a beautiful idea. So I think hopefully other people are making that kind of progression too, because there has been a lot of talk in the last couple of years about female participation in priesthood, and the rhetoric is changing, and there have been directives like from Elder Oaks saying don't talk about the priesthood passing the sacrament. So I think all of those things are great, and hopefully all of our thinking is shifting a bit.
So we've heard priesthood mentioned quite a bit already. Ordained Women started in 2013. You were already working on your book, but your book came out a year later. Were you involved in the Ordained Women movement, and why or why not?
I wasn't involved in the Ordained Women movement. My professional background is all in marketing, and I feel like one of my strengths is really understanding my audience, even if I don't agree with them, and understanding the most effective way to communicate a message that will change hearts and minds. And I feel that I just as a marketer, I disagreed with the tactics of Ordained Women, even though I knew a lot of the women involved in it and really had a lot of respect and deep appreciation for what they were trying to achieve. So I think, you know, I was starting from a point of understanding the church as a pretty mainstream body that moves pretty slowly because we are a large community and a deeply entrenched culture. I started with the premise that we all want to move as a body, as the body of Christ. We don't want to leave the arm or the leg behind, and that required a little bit more foundational ground-changing work, first of all. And that's what I've always felt that my strength is in, is really going to the very foundation of the membership and the foundation of the culture, and just sort of shifting that ground to where perhaps, you know, bigger changes can take place. But if you don't make that initial ground shifting movement first, then you end up breaking everything in the process.
So do you think that's just a bridge too far? They were reaching too high?
I think for that time, it absolutely was too much, too far, too fast.
So do you agree with their ultimate goal about priesthood for women?
I agree. Well, my vision of the church is a much more cooperative vision, where gender isn't erased and responsibilities aren't sort of coalesced into each other. My vision is more of a natural outgrowth of where we are today, and perhaps more attainable for where we are today in terms of a social structure and the cooperative structure of our men and our women, which is that we have two organizations. We have a priesthood organization, we have a Relief Society organization. And the Relief Society organization was established as a cooperative partnership to the men, and it was established to be on par with the men. And as I'm studying the 19th century now, I see where that organization came from and what it accomplished and what it was capable of and what those women were capable of. And I also see what those women were able to do because they had the support of other sisters and because they had a community of their own. And as someone who went to a private girls' school for 12 years and graduated only with girls and spent my entire educational curriculum only with girls, I understand that there is a sort of sacred space that can happen when you have women working together. And so I would hate to lose that. And that's always been my concern, is that without those two organizations working cooperatively together, then we would lose some of that beauty. That said, the Relief Society structure, in my opinion, has been largely lost since that original vision. We have the structure sort of innately built in to it, but it's been latent. We have Relief Society boards that used to travel, that used to do much more, that used to be responsible for curriculum and magazines and budgets, and none of that is in play right now. What I do think what's interesting is that since the Ordained Women Movement's greatest media height in 2014, and since the book came out, there have been female general officers who have been incorporated into key decision-making councils at the church. And I don't think that this is a small matter. I think that having their voice in there, even though it's probably, greatly overwhelmed by the voices of men in the council, I think that was a significant change that probably didn't get celebrated as much as it should have, because obviously it just happened in church headquarters. But I do think what's going to impact our experiences as men and women working together in wards and in stakes and in families is really focusing on that cooperative gender model rather than abolishing the gender's responsibilities altogether.
So speaking of that, we've had a couple of recent cases of sexual abuse by both a former mission president decades ago and then a pretty recent case. And do you think, and you do bring up in your book the whole what should we call mission president wives thing, do you think any of these things might not have happened or could have been prevented if mission presidents and their wives were co-presidents? Could that work, do you think?
I absolutely think that is an essential next step for the church institution, especially when it comes to mission presidents. And I wonder, as silly as it sounds, if the hesitancy to name co-presidents in the mission is really being held up by this discussion of what to call them, which would be unfortunate, but I wouldn't be entirely shocked. I think that there's a lot of hoop jumping that I see going on rhetorically to not call women co-presidents. In fact, I think I read an article recently that referred to a new mission president who was being called and his wife companion or something. It was so rhetorically awkward. It was like, you know, they're obviously trying to come up with something because in our eyes, we see her as such an integral part of that, you know, mission family, but it's just not quite happening yet. So I really, really am excited for the day when there are co-mission presidents and we can figure out what to call them. But in the meantime, that rhetoric is holding us back from really integrating that woman into every element of mission life, which she should be, especially with more women serving missions today. There's such a unique element to being a 19-year-old girl that only that mission mother can understand. And I just called her mission mother, but then it should be mission father too. We should call them mission fathers, but we're not. And I do think absolutely that some of these problems would be addressed if the... If she, we'll just say she, were really involved in the interviewing of those sister missionaries, for instance, if she was able to interview them privately, if she was really able to be a part of the decision making about transfers and who was living with whom. And not to say that that's not happening in some, but I think, again, the mission president's relationship can be varied, just the way we've been talking about the stake and award experiences can be varied. And so I'd love to see a standardization of that. And it's unfortunate that one of her roles may have to be keeping an eye out for abuse of those girls and those women. But you know, not to say that that would happen by the actual missionaries themselves, but you know, by the people in the community or by the ward members or, you know, heaven forbid, as we've seen now, by her husband. So, it seems a no-brainer.
So there's a real practical benefit.
Absolutely.
In having them be co-presidents and split up their duties and cater to the different genders. Would those things prevent some of these abuse situations from happening, or at least make it?
I think they would help prevent some of these abuse situations. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, we have to be realistic and say that, you know, every marriage is different, and the foundational culture that we are working from is still a culture of in which women do not have the experience, nor the confidence, nor the encouragement to be that voice of opposition to their husbands or to the larger community. And so that's an even bigger cultural problem to tackle. But I think if there are women who are being called as mission presidents who have had experience in a public sphere or who have that confidence and that encouragement to take a public role in that mission setting, I definitely think some of these problems can be stemmed. I will say that, I unfortunately have heard of more anecdotes than I would like that talk about a sort of collusion between men and women in some of these cases. There's also a very strange power dynamic that I've found very often in our culture, where women find their identities or their power in denying themselves or in denying other women the opportunities to speak up. So just a strange example that was shared with me recently. In Chile, there is a thing going around where the women believe that they can't be in a building by themselves, like a church building by themselves. And so a girl who recently returned from a mission there told me that these Relief Society presidencies of the wards in her mission were meeting in their cars outside the ward house because they couldn't go in the building without a priesthood authority. And so apparently, like, when they'd waited for, you know, they're either waiting for men to come and chaperone them in the building, or else they're meeting in their cars outside the building, and that there are women policing other women, right, and saying, oh, sister, you can't be in here, you have to have a man in here with you, and kicking them out of the building, or saying, oh, sister, you can't meet at the church, nobody can be there with you, you know, and sort of deriving a sense of power among her own constituency from this policing. And I've seen that in so many different forms over the years of women policing other women. And I just wonder, you know, what unfortunate cases we might see of that that, you know, that haven't yet been revealed.
So are you expecting a more Mormon Me Too cases to come forward, given the differential between male power and women?
That's a hard question. I don't know that I'm qualified to say whether there will be more or not. I mean, my cynical worldly side would say statistically the number of times that a woman has been in a room alone with a man in a church setting, there probably will be more. However, my more natural and hopeful inclination would be to say that we should not suspect every man that sits alone in a room with a woman, especially as I have been a professional woman in Utah and as I work with a lot of professional women in Utah. I would not be able to work in Utah if I did not sit in a conference room with a man, have a man in my office, or go out to lunch with a man. Mm-hmm. I mean, women are so disadvantaged when we apply that same principle to the workplace and demand that there be a chaperone or that, you know, something happen in a public place. And so, like I say, statistically, I think there's no doubt that more cases will come, but I hope that we don't take it to an extreme and go the other direction and say, well, I can never be in a room alone with you in any situation, because as a working woman in Utah or anywhere, that would be very detrimental to me.
As we wrap up, let me ask you a question then. You brought up the state. Tell us about Better Days 2020.
I'd love to. Thanks for asking. So this is my new project that I feel extremely passionate about, and I think it naturally grows out of all of my work that I've done so far with the Mormon Women Project and with Women at Church, and it also grows out of my professional capacity as a marketer. The organization started when it was pointed out to me that the year 2020 is an anniversary here in Utah, and it's the 150th anniversary of Utah being the first place where a woman cast a ballot in the modern nation. So that is a huge event that we think is worth celebrating. And for any history aficionados out there who are saying, what? Wyoming's legislature granted women the right to vote the month before Utah, but we actually had the first election in which a vote was cast. So that's what we're celebrating. And it was cast by Sarah Young up at the Council Hall building, which still stands. And so we love that anniversary sort of, you know, gives a little brand twist to Utah. You know, we unfortunately are often tagged and labeled in business media, especially for some pretty low statistics that we have. The Tribune reported last week or 2 weeks ago that Utah is now at the very bottom of the country in terms of wage gap, or I should say it has the largest mm-hmm. wage gap, has mm-hmm. the highest in the country in wage gap. But we have a number of other statistics like that too that sort of have given Utah a tarnished brand when it comes to women. 2020 is also the centennial of the 19th Amendment, which was the amendment that granted women the right to vote throughout the country. So women have been voting in the United States nationwide in federal elections for less than 100 years. And so we saw the confluence of these two anniversaries, and we just thought, what a wonderful opportunity for Utah to reclaim this history and reclaim its role as a leader in women's advocacy. And so through education, legislation, and art, our group is popularizing that Utah women's history. And we hope that it gives Utahns a permission, sort of sets the precedent, gives them a precedent that then gives them the permission to be women's advocates again. The state was founded on a principle of women's advocacy. It was founded on a sense of pride that we had let out in this way. And it was founded by women and men who really were pioneers in so many other regards than what we traditionally think of them. Our group was instrumental in having a statue of Dr. Martha Hughes Cannon sent to Washington, D.C. in 2020. She was one of the first women to attend medical school at UPenn. She had 4 degrees by the time she was 25 years old. She was the first and she was the resident physician of Deseret Hospital, which was an all-female-led hospital. And so she's just one example. She was kind of typical and representative of her community and of what the women were doing here at that time. And so we want to bring the spirit of that back to Utah today.
Where can people find more information about it?
BetterDays20202020.org.
There you go. Nyland, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For your insights. Appreciate it. Peggy, thanks for your coverage.
Always happy to be here.
You can find more stories on this topic and others at sltrib.com, and we'll catch you next time on Mormonland. Have a great week.